I'm sorry I couldn't speak to you yesterday. I was very jet lagged and I went to sleep at 8 o'clock. I only got here from Mumbai 3 days ago.
I can understand all this partying and, you know, it's
not partying, just answering questions continuously. I still haven't recovered from the jet lag because I got here so quickly. I mean, I just got here the day before the ceremony, so.
All right, okay.
And I usually take a week to recover from a long trip. So I was just very tired and, I'm sorry I couldn't speak to you yesterday.
Okay. No, it's all right. I won't take much of your time. But anyway, I can start if you are ready.
Yes, please go ahead.
All right, okay. Now tell me, when you started writing this book, could you dream where you are now?
Actually, no, because Vijay, when I was writing this book, it was a very difficult time in my life. I had quit my full-time job in Delhi with Time Magazine at the start of 2006, at the end of 2005. So January 1, 2006, for the first time in my life, I was by choice unemployed, so I wanted to write this book. But as of December 2006, after 11 months, I still hadn't done much, so I still hadn't got a book that I was happy with. So it was a very difficult time because I had quit my job, taken a big gamble, and, you know, I was just... I was also thinking of moving from Delhi to Bombay, so I was also doing a lot of things. And it was a difficult time. And, you know, even to make the long list for the Man Booker Prize is a great dream for a first-time writer. And from making the long list to the short list to winning, it's quite extraordinary. And I don't think it has fully sunk in yet.
And not many people in India take that sort of leap of faith. Were there any moments when you thought that, okay, I think I might have done a mistake?
Oh, absolutely. But the thing for me, Vijay, is I'm not married and I have no family to support. I wouldn't have done it otherwise. If I had children in school, there's no way I could have done it. What I realized was I was getting older. I was in my 30s now. In 2006, I realized I was well into my 30s and it was now or never. I had always had a plan of stopping my full-time job to do the writing, but, you know, being a good middle-class South Indian that I am, I was very frightened of leaving my job. And it finally came to the point where I said, if you don't do it in 2006, you'll never do it. So I took the plunge, and then immediately, within 3 or 4 months, I was worrying every day if I made a mistake, because once you quit a job like that, it's very hard to go back full-time, because your editors will remember that you quit, you know, and they'll wonder if they can ever take you back in a full-fledged capacity. So it was a big gamble, and I was very frightened of what I was doing. Definitely, there was a lot of anxiety. But again, it's not something I could recommend to anyone else, because if you have a family and children, especially in troubled financial times like these, there's no way I would have done it if my situation were different.
Tell me about your childhood. We don't know much about that.
I was born in Madras, Chennai, which is then called Madras, because I'm not Tamil. I'm actually from ethnically from Karnataka, from Bangalore. My parents were living in Chennai. So I was born in Chennai in October 74. And until I was 6 years old, I grew up in Chennai. In 1980, my father is a doctor. He decided to go back to Bangalore. And so... I have a brother, Anand, who's 5 years older than me. So Anand, my mother and father, we went back to Mangalore. Now Mangalore is a much smaller town. Now it's become a city, but back then it wasn't that big. So in Mangalore, I lived from about 1980 until 1990. In 1990, my mother died, and that was when my father decided to leave India. And my father went to Australia, and I went with him for a couple of years, and I didn't like it at all, so I left Australia. My brother, Anand, had gone from India to Stanford University in California to study, so I had this idea that I would do what my brother was doing. And for my bachelor's, I went to Columbia University in New York, and I did my BA there. After that, I came to England because I got a scholarship from Columbia to continue studying. So I came to England and did my MPhil in English Literature at Magdalen College, Oxford. And then I felt that I had spent a lot of time as a student and I wanted to see the world at large. And the way to do it was journalism. I was very lucky because this was in 2000 when the economy was booming. Now it's hard to believe the kind of times, you know, those were. and jobs were just all around, and it was very easy to do something that today I think would be impossible. I just made the switch from academics to journalism almost overnight. I got an internship at the Financial Times, and I began with them. And then finally I got a job at Time Magazine and went back to Delhi in 2003. And from 2003 to the end of 2005, as I described, I was with Time in Delhi, and then I moved to Mumbai, where I live now. Mm-hmm. So from 2006 to today, I've been in Mumbai. That's my life.
Was there a sense of dislocation? Because at the young age, you leave India, go to Australia, from there go to America.
I wasn't that young. I was about almost 16 when my mother died, which is, and then my father moved, and so I had to go with my father. It was a traumatic time then, because my mother had died from cancer. It was a very sudden cancer that came on, and so it was a period when my life was in chaos. Your question is an interesting one, and definitely when I was outside, I was eager to come back to India. But one of the things I wasn't sure was what I wanted to do with my life, and I was frightened that I would come back and have nothing to do, because I thought I'd become an academic. And being an academic meant, finishing a PhD, which I knew I wanted to do abroad, because I had the chance to study at some very good universities. For the longest time, there was confusion as to what I would do with my life, which meant I stayed in academics a long time. But the moment, when I got into journalism, I knew I wanted to come back to India as a journalist, and I was waiting for a chance to do that. So I was very aware of the need to come back, but I wanted to come back on with a job. So by nature, I'm very conservative, and I didn't want to come back and then look for a job.
What drew you back to India? What was the charm of India for somebody who could be anywhere in the world?
Well, the charm is that it's home. I mean, as I said, I hadn't left on my terms. I was taken out when I was, after my mother died. It was just, I didn't leave out of choice. Like a lot of people go with their families, I went with my father. I had always wanted to come back just travel and see, because I had seen very little of India. I knew that I'd only seen Mangalore and Madras, and that's not even, that's just a thumbnail of the country. I wanted to travel and see more of India, but not travel like a tourist. I wanted to go and talk to people. I knew journalism would get me a much better insight in India than anything else, so I did that.
What kind of things you were looking at, and what made you interested in when you were going to the remote parts of India?
Yeah, I was very keen to travel in North India, because the Ganga and the places along it, places that you hear about, they have this kind of fabled, legendary quality to them. Cities like Allahabad, Benares, Kanpur. I'd always wanted to see these places. But when you're growing up in South India now, these places are completely cut off from you. There is no reason you would go to Benares. My father's uncles had gone to Benares in the 40s and 50s to study at the Benares Hindu University, because back then it was a famous center of learning. But by today, the South is so far advanced in education, educational opportunities, even employment, that there is a sense of estrangement from this traditional Indian hinterland. And I was very curious to see this hinterland, or this heartland of the country, that I had never seen at all. My plan always was to travel as much as I could in UP and Benares, in UP and Bihar. I wasn't looking for anything in particular. I was just going about and seeing things. And then you realize that conditions in UP and Bihar are profoundly different, and in many ways are shockingly bad. And there are things you can't imagine when you grow up in Mangalore, or the reality in the villages along North India. A lot more violence, a lot more poverty than you can imagine. It doesn't fit your conception of India when you grow up in Mangalore or in South India. It's hard for you to believe that some of the things that you see are truly in India along the North. Just to give you one example, in Kolkata, even today, you have handpull rickshaws. And when I tell this in Bombay to people, they don't believe me. That is, there are things within some parts of India that would strike people in other parts of India as just being too strange to be true, or too backward to be true. Even today, because Bombay has no rickshaws of any kind, either cycle or handful rickshaws. And my friends in Bombay who have never been to Kolkata refuse to believe that there really are handful rickshaws operating even today in the city of Kolkata. There is so much to see in India that will surprise, will startle, will delight you. And this novel really came out of my travels along the north.
Michael Portillo, in his speech, mentioned the word that you have portrayed, the dark side of India. In Western writings, we have seen this dark side of India, whether it was Naipaul or Rushdie or many other writers. What's different this time?
Well, first of all, do you feel Rushdie portrays the dark side? I wouldn't think that...
The controversial side rather than dark side, I would say, or maybe the fine balance by Rohinton Mystery, you know.
Again, okay, so I'm curious, I wouldn't argue, Naipaul is a different case, but with Mystery and Rushdie, I don't think either of them portrays the dark side, and I don't think mine does either. I think so much of the literature that comes out of India, I think, does portray a very romanticized, idealized India, a middle-class India, you know, where everything is lyrical, and everyone is funny and cute, and anything that jars with that image would upset readers who are familiar with that genre. This is true in the West and in India, because the same literature is consumed here and by middle-class English-speaking readers in India as well. There's a particular literary India that's been created, through novels, short stories, and so forth. And anything that breaks the mold that even tries to bring into the canvas a poorer person is immediately criticized for showing the dark side, or showing poverty. Whereas, in fact, the attempt of people like Mystery is just to expand the literary canvas to include all of India. So I think this term is unfortunate, and I don't believe that's what I'm doing. And I would argue that what I'm trying to do is to expand the literary scene, to expand the literary canvas, to include a member of the Indian underclass who is increasingly being written out of not just our literature, but also our Hindi films. You rarely see people like Balram Halwai in the cinemas, although they're all around Delhi.
There were some reviews in India when your book came out where the reviewers felt pretty offended or pretty angry. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I would like to point out the book has done exceptionally well in India, long before the announced. My publishers tell me it has sold about 20,000 hardcover copies, and that's a lot. That's a huge number for India, for anywhere really. So it's been a bestseller and gone into reprint even long before this prize was announced. So clearly, the people have responded positively to the book, or they wouldn't be buying it because it's an expensive book. It's 395 rupees a copy. And secondly, I would say that a lot of reviews were positive. I think the majority were probably positive. And yes, there definitely were some reviewers who were upset. But when I wrote a book like this, it was definitely one of my aims to provoke and even to disturb some people, because I think I have a journalist instinct in that unless something upsets some people, it can't be good. I have this journalist instinct, and I did mean for it to challenge people's conception of the India around them and what they're seeing, just force them to think again about it. And I knew that I was taking the risk of offending some people, but frankly, I think provocation is one of the legitimate goals of literature. I've tried hard that everything in the book should have a correlation in reality. It's all fiction and made up, but for instance, what I'm saying is a fact like Balram's father, who's a rickshaw puller, died of TB. And every day in India, about 1,000 people die of TB. And a poor man pulling a rickshaw would be a very high-risk group. So some people might get offended that TB is being depicted, tuberculosis is being depicted. But TB is such a fact of life in India. If it offends you, if the depiction in the book offends you, then what you should do is make sure it gets eliminated in reality around you.
I was listening to one of your interviews on the internet, perhaps it was the Saja one, if I remember correctly, where you said that politics and crime are the only two ways to go up in India.
No, I meant if you want to get rich quickly, not it's the only way to go up. Say you're a poor man and you come from UP to Delhi or anywhere you are in India, and you have the same aspirations that middle-class people do, because the media, billboards, advertising all beam the same images at you of, you know, success, becoming an entrepreneur. The same dreams are shared by all people of all classes. But the middle class have a way to achieve those dreams because they have education, they speak English. If they fall ill, they can go to a hospital. They have insurance. The police are basically there to protect them. And if you're a poor person, you begin to participate in the same dreaming process. You want those things, but you have nothing. You have no education. If you fall, you don't speak English probably. If you fall ill, you will lose your job, you know, because there's no insurance, the hospitals you have access to are not good. So you have the dreams, but not the infrastructure to achieve those dreams. And the net result is how can you get there? And this is already leading to frustration and the realization there are only two ways to get rich quick in your lifetime if you're poor, and those are crime or politics. Those are the only two forms of entrepreneurship open to many, many poor people in this country, in India, sorry, not in England. That's what I meant when I said that, and I think that is true. If you want your life to improve by 10%, sure, you can be a driver in Delhi, and your life will be slightly ahead. I do portray this in the novel, where some drivers are discussing, the Balram is asking, what will happen to me, you know, 10 years from now, where will I be? And the other driver tells him, well, you know, if you get lucky, you'll stay healthy, and so you make up enough money, and you send your son to college, and your son will become English educated and go to college. And for Balram, that's not enough. He wants it in his lifetime. And if you want to become that English-speaking, you know, entrepreneur in your lifetime, then if you're a poor man in Delhi, there's only two ways out. And these are the two I've talked about.
How is your writing days structured? Do you wake up early in the morning? Or
there are two kinds of writing I do. One is the fiction writing, and the other is journalism, which I continue to do and I enjoy very much. And I try to do the literary or the fiction writing in the morning if I can, because that's just... when I'm fresh, and then I read the newspapers, and then as the day goes on, I'm more likely to do journalism.
In one way, you have joined India's Olympic gold medalist Abhinav Bindra, the most eligible bachelor in India.
No one has made that comparison before. I have to say, Olympic gold medal is a far bigger deal, because you know, when Bindra won that was that is. A lot more people seem tuned into that than perhaps the literary award in India.
But you have an added problem that nobody gives you flat in Bombay to a bachelor.
Well, this is very true. I mean, this is in Bombay especially. What has happened in the past year is the concern about terrorism has really grown in Bombay. So people renting out flats have become really paranoid. And if you're not married, which I'm not, and if you don't have a full-time job, which I don't, because, you know, I'm a writer and a freelancer, it becomes very, very difficult to find a place. I had real problems this time. Many of the housing societies in Mumbai have a clause saying, you cannot rent to a bachelor. It's just not allowed. So a lot of suspicion and apprehension, which has grown recently, has meant that I have real trouble finding a place. I did find a place eventually, but it was a real problem this time. And it's partly, you know, it's funny, but it's not especially funny if you're the fellow looking for a place.
So any plans for marriage?
No, right now the only plan is to finish the next, you know, to keep writing.
I believe your next book is also in the pipeline.
Yes, I've been doing it for some time, but it's still a while away, and I don't know when it will be done, but it's still a while away.
And have you found a bank to put your £50,000?
I'm taking it back home, so we'll see. It'll definitely be a nationalized bank, I'll tell you. It'll definitely be a government bank. Not a private sector bank, that's for sure.
Now that you're returning back to India, so how does it feel to be in that league of Naipaul, Rushdie, Arundhati Roy, and Kiran Desai?
You mentioned Rushdie, and you know, after he won the Booker, all these supermodels began chasing him. So the day they begin chasing me, I believe I'm in that league, not until then.
Okay, I wish you all the best.